You're about to listen to an unfiltered conversation with Seth Godin. Hailed as a 20-time best-selling author, entrepreneur, and marketing genius, Seth has been a driving force in shaping the way in which you think about business, creativity, and personal growth. In this episode, you'll learn how to build a world-changing brand, navigate your self-doubt, and how to use technology to build a better life. But before we get into the episode, I just have one favor to ask of you. 4 years ago, my brother and I started this very podcast with the main goal of building a toolkit to heal a divided world. And with each upload, we're getting closer and closer to that goal. So if you're listening right now, we'd love to have you along this journey. And you can do that by subscribing, following, liking, and sharing this episode with a friend. Thank you and enjoy. This is really a dream come true. Like, we've been reading and listening to your stuff for so long now, to the point where my mom's like, yeah, I even read his stuff. Like, this is a full circle moment. So this is a full circle moment. So I just want to say this is awesome. This is awesome. Oh,
any friend of Jim's, and the work you're doing is important. So I'll, no illusions that I will change the world, but I'm happy to contribute.
Seth, you're a 20-time best-selling author. You created one of the first internet companies, Yoyodyne. You're an educator, a thought leader on a variety of subjects, marketing, branding, culture, the internet, you name it. But I want to start this conversation by pulling a quote of yours that we did in our research that I actually think goes a level deeper. And I want to start with this. I don't have much expertise, but I'm good at asking questions about the way the world works. How have you gone about building your ability to ask meaningful questions?
So here's the story. Do you know the that glass bird that dips into water over and over again? You've seen that thing. It's a little toy, right? So I set it up in front of four straight-A students who are between 12 and 15 years old, and it's bouncing back and forth. And I'm like, so how does it work? And they look at it, and they look at it, and they take out their notebooks, and they say, we don't know, tell us, so they could write down the answer. I said, no, you can ask me questions, but I want you to figure out how it works. They couldn't even begin. And it was a heartbreaking moment for me. I think that either you see things in the world you don't understand and you let them go, or you see things in the world you don't understand and you say, why is it like that? And you assert, and if you want to ask ChatGPT, that's fine, but it's better to just assert why it might be like that, come up with a theory, test the theory. That's my method. That has been my method since I was 6 years old. And 8,000 blog posts later, I just notice things and I assert, this might be an explanation. If you don't like my explanation, come up with a better one. But we are living in a really complicated place, and yet too many people have been indoctrinated to just accept it as written.
Mm. You're clearly incredibly well-researched, well-read, well-trained, and you mention asking how things work. And so before we even go back to the early days, I want to start with today. Where are you looking to challenge your beliefs right now? What things are you asking? Why does it work that way?
Well, I think that we are finally confronting the end of the industrial age, the beginning of the carbon generation. Apologies from everyone my age to the people your age for leaving such a mess. But at the same time, the reality of the long tail, that there is, you know, a show like Succession, which was written up so many times and won so many Emmy Awards or nominations, was seen by 1/15th as many people who watched The Monkees, any given episode of The Monkees or Gilligan's Island. That the you know, Taylor Swift has never had an album that sold as many copies as Hootie and the Blowfish. So you just have to realize that if you're a creator of anything, including a podcast or a book, it's never going to have the impact it used to. And that fracturing could be good or it could be bad, but it's real.
Mm. How do we add a positive light on that fracturing?
Well, the only reason that there is gay marriage is because we had a fracturing. The only reason that people are able to speak up about where they are in neurodiversity is because there's been this fracturing. The only reason that various artists have overlooked backgrounds and caste systems are heard is because of this. That a cultural hegemony run by a few gatekeepers had huge cultural advantages, but it also had very significant costs.
You know, I think a lot of what you talk about is related to the focus on brand. You're one of the OG brand builders in my eyes on the internet. And, you know, specifically building a brand that doesn't just align with your mission, but also a community's vision. And I think a ton of people have read your work and have caught on, hence the rise of social media fame and new authors and new podcasters, et cetera. But with this newfound hype in brand building, what do you think is this one thing that people still haven't caught on to yet when trying to build a brand of substance?
Can I say three things instead?
Of course. Of course, the more the merrier. Okay.
Thing number one is a brand is not a logo. People talk about branding, but they really mean is they're making a logo. Number two is that hype and promotion is not marketing. Hype, promotion, and hustle is hype, promotion, and hustle. Marketing is living a true story that other people want to talk about. And so the third thing that people don't understand is you will never again be able to serve everyone. Everyone is a trap. You need to be there for someone. And if you can't tell me who your someone is and you're just hoping to get picked, then you are living 30 years ago. That what it means to have a brand is that you've made a promise to a group of people about what to expect from you tomorrow. And that promise should be specific and it should be grounded in who people want to engage with and who they want to become, not say, this is just my hustle to make myself a dollar.
Hmm. When it comes to, you know, people changing their brand and their image over time, as one does, I'm sure, you know, every celebrity, every person who's built something of substance goes through eras. Like now is like the YouTube era where you see YouTubers who are changing in real time from somebody who made videos for children to now somebody who's an established podcaster. There's a bunch that I can name off the top of my head. How do we deal with that dissonance of somebody subscribing to you for what you once were, but still wanting to actively change, but you don't want to leave, you know, your past followers out of the loop? How do you go about transitioning without disregarding the people who are part of the origin?
So the brand is the promise. And if you can't, in good conscience, make the promise to the old people, you have to wish them well. And, you know, I don't know why I'm talking about Hootie and the Blowfish so much today, but Hootie and the Blowfish made a very specific promise in the 1990s to a large number of people that they're going to be the music you can listen to in a sports bar. Well, Darius Rucker wanted to be a country western singer. So he made a new promise to a new group of people. And if that disappoints the Hootie and the Blowfish fans, that's okay. You can't have it both ways. And a great example of this is what happened after Bob Dylan had his motorcycle accident. Before that, he was fully embraced by the folk tradition and the anti-war movement. And he decided to go out on tour, a tour that has never ended since then, and go to the same cities 3 years in a row. And his promoter said, that's stupid. You need to go to new cities to develop new audiences. He said, no, I want to go three times because the first time I go, it will disappoint most of the people who are there and they won't come back. And the second time I go, the people who like me will come back. And the third time I go, they'll bring their friends. So he intentionally burned down the old thing so he would have the freedom to make the new thing.
When we look in a mirror, we learn a lot from the statements we say to the external. So I want to reflect the mirror onto yourself, Seth. Who are you speaking to right now? What's your promise? And I'd also be curious if you could touch on who you think you've lost in the new promises that you've made.
So I helped redefine what marketing was because the internet destroyed what marketing used to be. And that meant that a whole bunch of people who wanted to hustle and who wanted to, you know, figure out how to do pop-ups and pop-unders and search data were in my follower circle because there weren't too many other people talking about internet marketing. I have willfully and intentionally walked away from those people. And then the sweet spot for me was sort of the leader inside of a company who wanted to do things a different way. But I spent a year and a half of my life making this book as a volunteer, and 300 other people worked with me on it. There's a whole bunch of companies that don't want anything to do with me anymore because I told the truth about the impact that they were making. I'm like, great, good luck, but it's all of our share of this planet. If you don't want to come, I can't make you. And then in the practice, I said, you can give me the benefit of the doubt about my previous work, but this is about being a creative. And that's different than being someone in a company. So I'm well aware that I've earned the benefit of the doubt from a core group of people. And sometimes they tell their friends. And sometimes the friends they tell are different people. So I need to sound like me, but I don't need to repeat what I said yesterday.
I love that. I want to dive into the Carbon Almanac. It was actually slotted a little later in our conversation, but since you brought it up, I think it's a good place to dive into. I was very fascinated in the way you approached the structure of that project, largely that it was collaborative, almost felt like open source coding projects, but in a lane few and far between for folks who are concerned about the world. Walk me through that decision. How do you get to that point as someone who, I'm sure you could have written the book all yourself, but you make an active decision not to. What galvanized that decision?
So in the old days, I used to be a book packager, and I actually made more almanacs than just about anyone on earth. I did the Business Almanac, the People Magazine Celebrity Almanac, the Women's Almanac. So I love almanacs, and I knew what I needed the almanac to do, because there were plenty of books on climate. But there weren't books that you could just sort of browse for 5 minutes and have a conversation about. And then I said, well, if I spent 2 years of my life developing the point of view, the expertise, the insight to do this, A, that would be a long, lonely 2 years. But B, it wouldn't be a model for how we're going to solve our problem. The way we're going to solve our problem is we're going to see it's a system, and we're going to change the system. So I said, what if I built a system to make this book instead of making the book? And I learned so much. I met people who will be my friends and colleagues for the rest of my life. It has been a magical experience. And that was a byproduct of seeing the system as opposed to just saying, I'll fix this thing.
Zoom in a little bit into that system for us that you built with others. What created an effective project? And many people try to start things with new folks, but it falls apart. Many movements have fallen apart for this reason.
Right.
What are some of those core tenets that allowed it to survive and now thrive?
Okay, so you have to begin with going in a direction that other people want to go. So if you're going to do open source coding, you need programmers to do it with you who like coding. You can't go try to find someone who doesn't like coding to join you. That's not going to happen. The second thing, and this is where it falls apart, is there's a difference between a community and open collaboration. A community can have a leader. So I didn't make decisions that other people could make, but I made decisions that only I could make. And I stuck with them. I know how to manage projects. I've done hundreds of books. I've never missed a deadline. I've never gone over budget. And this wasn't going to be the first time. So I was very clear. This is what a good page looks like. This is not acceptable. This is the day it's going to be done. This is how long it is. We're not going to argue about this, and we're not going to argue about that. And if you want to have an argument about that, please go somewhere else. And there were like two people I had to kick out because I was like, I get it. Free speech is a real thing, but free speech is about the government. It is not about this community. We are here to make a thing, and it will be done on February 28th. And gaining enrollment and clarity, I didn't tell anybody which page to write. When someone said, we want to put in a page about big banks, I didn't say, I'm not interested in that. I said, if it works, please do. And that ability to create, I'll use a carbon analogy, the freeway, but let anyone drive is key. What happens in a lot of organizations is they forget to pave the road. And if you don't pave the road, you're not going to get anywhere.
Mm. Was that how you always managed?
So management and leadership are different, as I write about in Song of Significance. I'm a terrible manager. And I think there are two reasons for that. Sometimes I lack the empathy for someone to hear my instructions the way I'm saying them. And second, it makes me very uncomfortable to make people uncomfortable. And I really like leading, which is creating the conditions for people to do what they wanted to do all along. So someone led the podcast revolution, but no one managed the two of you into having a podcast.
Yeah. No, that's I'm just digesting that. I love that point. I love, it's the processing time. You see the loading bars going. I love it. Yeah. Well, it seems as though your leadership style has a lot of decisiveness in the sense of like, here's the mission that we're going. There's room for entropy, but we cut out the room for, at least in the way in which you typically frame it, you remove the word "and" to embody frames of success. So you say, here's my defined vision. Here's the deadline. Wherever you want to guide that narrative to get to that deadline, so be it. That's how we build a team. That's how we build a collective. But when I think about the word "and" in particular, I think about Gen Z and our relationship to it, because I see ourselves as the relationship of the resume building generation. I take a few scrolls on social media and I see one friend who's, you know, curing diseases with orphans in Africa, and I scroll down a few more posts and they have a Guinness World Record, and they have like all of these, you know. You know, so it's right, just well, like more.
Joey, we gotta dig deep into your psyche here, but before we do, because I'm a semantics person.
Sure.
"And" really works for me in a project, "but" does not. And the whole key to the almanac was extinguishing the "but." Right? We're gonna do this thing, but we left out a fact. Okay, fine. We're still gonna do this thing, but it's not gonna be perfect. Okay, fine. We're still gonna do this thing. "And," which comes from improv in Chicago, is when you're in a scenario in improv, you never say "but" and you never say "no." You say "and." Like, you're sitting here with a pillow over your head and I'm working in a hamburger stand. Not, you're not allowed to have a pillow over your head. So that's different than what you're talking about. This is the generation that is getting a lot of pushback simply because they're not trying for more in so many ways, because the industrial promise that has been made to you, that was made to your parents, was broken so many times that a whole bunch of your peers are saying, "I don't believe you. You're telling me I should go to work for you. I should work as many hours as you want. I should come into the office when you say, because then I'm going to get promoted and promoted and promoted, and then I'll be rich. Yeah, you promised my parents that same thing and you didn't deliver." That is leading to a different kind of "but" slash "and," which is, you made me these promises, but you don't keep them. I'm also discovering that because I have a supercomputer on my desk that is connected to over a billion people, it is possible for me to weave together moments of magic and creation that my parents couldn't even dream of. So yeah, there certainly have always been resume hunters, but I'm discovering a huge number of people in their 20s who are building things with tiny teams that most people could never imagine.
Mm. I resonate with that so much. I could think of so many different people in my personal life that I admire who are doing just as you've said. And in one part of this, I think it's about putting the horse blinders on. But there are moments to put horse blinders on. There are moments to explore. But I want to talk about those horse blinders. You've said before that your success could be attributed to not going to places that make you second guess your decisions. I want to ask the inverse of that question, which is to say,
I don't remember saying that. So tell me what I meant.
I'll add a little bit more color, that you're not very active on social media and you kind of stay within your own lane in the sense of, I'm blogging, I'm writing, I'm doing my thing. It's great that Threads is out. Zuckerberg seems like a cool guy, but this isn't really my domain right now, you know? And so...
Okay, now you know? I know what you're getting at. So I'm sorry for jumping, Asher.
No, you're
first
good.
Of
no,
all,
no,
I don't think Zuckerberg's a cool guy, but that he used to live 4 miles from me, but that's a whole other story.
Boom, roasted. I want that story eventually, but continue, please.
The reason I don't use social media is not because it would cause me to second guess decisions I've made. It's because I would become mediocre at a lot of things. And because I can't spend time on Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter, I have to spend an extra half hour building tomorrow's blog post. That pushes me to be really good at something as opposed to pretty good at a lot of things.
I love that. And thank you for the pushback as well and for the clarification, because it helps us get to that moment where we could see the clarity. I would also love to get a sense of, where do you feel affirmed in your decision-making? You've said the practice, right? So showing up every single day, doing the thing. Are there other locations in your life where you feel affirmed in the decisions that you've made?
This is a really juicy question. So do you know Annie Duke's work?
Not familiar, no. Please enlighten.
She used to be the world's poker champion, and she's a brilliant author and good friend. And she has highlighted the difference between a good decision and a good outcome. So I'll do this with you live right now if you guys are up for it. Joy, can you think of a really good decision you made in the last 6 months?
Yeah, sending this email to have the conversation with you.
Okay. And what about you, Asher, leaving me out of it?
Deciding not to take a full-time job and pursue entrepreneurship full-time.
Okay. And did that work out so far?
So far, so good.
So what happens is she's asked thousands of people this question and everyone picks something that worked out. But whether or not it worked out doesn't mean it's a good decision. If you buy a lottery ticket and you win, it was still stupid to buy a lottery ticket because lottery tickets are a bad decision. Do the math. They don't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So a good decision has nothing to do with the outcome. Good outcomes are random events that are maximized by good decisions, but they're not the same thing. So to have a good decision affirmed to me means, did you make a decision and after the emotions were gone, did you look at it and say, based on what I see after the emotions are gone, am I glad I decided that, regardless of whether the outcome was good or not? And if the answer is yes, then your decision is affirmed. So in my case, I've had so many lucky outcomes, the byproduct of privilege, of lucky breaks, of showing up on the regular. There are people all around the world who give me the benefit of the doubt. There's the ability to live a life of enormous amounts of freedom. And all of that happened because I persisted in affirming decision-making skills before I looked at the outcome to decide if it was a good decision or not.
Honing in on that ability to make decisions, there's a lot of extraneous variables in our ecosystem right now, which are making us doubt our decisions. I know for mm-hmm. myself, I'm 20 years old and the world seems more confused, more clouded than ever. How have you gone about, even though it was a different time in which you were growing up at this age, how have you gone about sharpening that axe of decision-making in a world which was also clouded?
Leaving climate aside for a moment, we don't need to worry about the world. You're not going to be the emperor of the world. You're never going to have a podcast that has 100 million downloads a week. The world is irrelevant. There's somebody, there's not everybody. So beginning by intentionally making your world as small as you can manage helps you get enormous clarity about decision-making. So when I graduated from business school, what did I know? I know I wanted to work for a fast-growing company. Why? Because it made it way more likely that I was going to get to do interesting work faster than if I worked for a big, slow company. Okay, in 1983, what were the fastest growing companies that had anything to do with anything I was interested in? The answer was consumer software companies, because that was right around the time of the Apple II. It was just before the Mac. Things were happening, Activision, video games. So I was only left with 25 companies to choose from in the whole world. I could ignore everything else and say, what's the best way for me to get a job in a fast growing? Did it matter whether it was here or there or making this product? It didn't, because that's not what the primary focus of the decision making was. So part of the challenge of a generation that's coming up, you've had the internet your whole life, is there's too many choices. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to say but and but and but and but until you pick nothing. And what I encourage people to do is to pick something. That decision is random. After that, you will make the best decision you can based on the data you get.
The data we get at times can be very confusing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know what to listen to and what not for yourself.
Right.
Have you spoken at length about rejection, 800 publishers, not picking up your first book, you know, maybe not even getting a job? What data should we really be listening to? How do we avoid the abstraction and focus on the select few voices that matter?
Yeah, this is a brilliant question. Our goal is to turn data into information. And so if the data that's coming by is based on too small a sample set or randomized, it's very hard to turn it into information. So if you spend a lot of time listening to a radio station from Lithuania and you don't speak the language, you've learned nothing, right? There's data, but there's no information. So what we get to do, even in fast-moving marketplaces, is pattern match. Who came before us? And how can we look at where, what path did they take? And what can we, what are the important parts? So here's what we know. The kind of shoes you wear when you go to pitch a venture capitalist, not interesting. Doesn't matter. There is no information there. You can get all the data you want on that. You will learn nothing. But if there's a certain kind of company you want to start and there's only 15 people who've made it to the other side, what do all 15 have in common? What's their pattern? Has something happened in the world that would make their pattern less relevant now? So if you want to be a musician, the old pattern is, did Atlantic Records give you a contract? Then you know, so now you know you got to go do that. Not true anymore. In fact, now it would get you completely sidetracked if you were trying to get a major record label to pick you. So that moment is the agent of change. And my dad used to teach at the business school in Buffalo, and I used to correct his exams when I was 17, and I needed to find in every essay, where did the student write agent of change? So that's what we're looking for. Where is the agent of change? How will this change existing patterns that came before? And so in my case, when you're talking about the 800 rejection letters, I was bad at giving editors in New York what they wanted. The agent of change was not that the book publishing industry was changing or falling apart. It wasn't. It was the peak. It was, what do people who are good at this know that I don't know? How can I go look at what they did and match their patterns? And that's exactly what I did. I learned from the rejections. I didn't send the same thing over and over again. I said, oh, this is one more thing that gets me closer to that template. Let me go follow that. That rant run lasted 10 years. And then the new agent of change was the internet. And as soon as the internet showed up, I couldn't sell what I used to sell because they didn't want to buy what I used to make. So I had to shift gears and say, now what am I going to do? Because I see the agent of change. So in your case, it seems pretty obvious to me. There are two, maybe three giant agents of change, big ones, AI, carbon, and shifts in culture due to willful division. And if you look at those three things, there's a whole bunch of new decisions that you can make.
Let's say you were 18, 19, 20. You see those three changes. How are you navigating those relationships? How are you getting the right kind of information to make informed decisions?
Well, you got to find who your heroes are. What's the pattern you're trying to match, right? Are you trying to say, I would love to have a company with 100 employees in it, with $30 million in the bank? There's a pattern for how you do that. Or do you want the freedom of starting a new no-code business every month and each one makes you $15,000 a month and you have no employees, right? There's all these different patterns. Go to some meetups, hang out on Stack Overflow or Reddit or whatever it is. The people who have found out the pattern, you can't shut them up. They will keep telling you their pattern. You just got to listen.
Very true. Yeah. Very
yeah,
true.
Yeah, it's funny because it's, my parents always talk about, man, I would have killed to have the resources that you guys have. So it's funny to hear more and more like we are sitting on gold. As you said before, you know, we have the highest processing power in our pockets, but it's all about mobilizing the access points that we have. What's one way in which, or maybe not one way, as many ways as you would like to take it, how you go about adding optimism into the age of technological development where there's a lot of news? What makes you optimistic given all this technological change?
So reassurance is futile because once I finish reassuring you, you'll need more reassurance tomorrow. But I will tell you two things. The first thing is the year I was born, we were about to enter the Cuban Missile Crisis and we were 7 minutes away from the world being completely destroyed by atomic weapons. And it was the year after the Berlin blockade when we were 4 minutes away from the world being destroyed by atomic weapons. And I grew up near Love Canal, which was the original OG toxic waste dump near Buffalo, New York. And Three Mile Island happened when I was 13 years old. So, you know, we've seen this movie before. Yeah. But the real thing is this. If you want to be a pessimist, go ahead. Will that help? If being a pessimist will help, you have my blessing. In my experience, being an optimist makes it more likely that you will create better outcomes.
I love it. Seth, as we're nearing the end of our conversation, we typically like to round out these kinds of chats with what we call the DP3, the three conversations to pull everything together.
Okay.
The first of which I would like to propose to you, is what is something you've recently changed your mind on?
I work very hard to change my mind a lot. And trying to think of a useful, relevant one. You know, the biggest, most expensive change was when I realized that I had dismissed the World Wide Web and the internet when I was running an email company. It took me 9 months or 6 months to change my mind. That cost me a few billion dollars. So that's expensive. A few years ago, I changed my mind about how rosy I should have been about what happens when you give everyone in the world a microphone, that we're not all just going to sing nice songs together. Some people are going to weaponize it and use it against us. And in the last 6 weeks, I've become guardedly, marginally more optimistic about the climate. It's only been a year and a week since we launched the Carbon Almanac, and people are talking about it more. The technology is advancing so much faster than anyone expected. We're still in deep shit, but I am more optimistic than I was.
Yeah. Odds are, given the millions of people that have listened to your work and read your work, there's a bunch of people that support you. I know that you got a room full of people right now who are just like, let's go, Seth. We love your stuff. But I'm sure there's also maybe a slight few people in that category of listeners that may not necessarily agree. And
I hope
are
so.
Maybe captive critics. What would you say to those people right now if they were sitting in the same exact recording studio?
They're absolutely right. Based on who they are, what they know, what they want, what they believe, they're absolutely right to disagree with me. And I have never said that I know any right answers. I'm just saying, based on who I am, what I see, what I know, this is what I am coming to the conclusion of. If you have a different take on it, please go for it. It's not personal. And to attack someone personally makes no sense because I mean no evil. But I've been wrong a lot. My job is not to be right. My job is to give people a way to think about where they are.
And you've done just that on this pod, Seth, so we appreciate you for it. We'll end with this final question, one that I hope you'll enjoy. What is giving you hope in the world right now?
So I was in Northern Canada a few weeks ago. I drove up there, and first thing I saw shortly after I arrived at a place that had never in my 43 years of going there had a fire is a blazing conflagration that burned down a building. It started just as I drove in. And a group of people who had only spent a couple weeks with each other beforehand put the fire out 45 minutes before the fire department got there. That when people come together with a goal, they can accomplish something. And then I got on the lake in my canoe, and I paddled with the loons and the beaver, and I realized that they were still there. They might be struggling, but they are still there. And then the third thing that happened was I spent a lot of time with some 8-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds, and I saw that humanity still wants to make things better and still wants to level up. And the combination of those three things reminded me that there's a lot of work to do, but it's worth doing.
Thank you for doing your work. Thank you for even inspiring Joey and I to start this. I still recall all but 4 years ago when I read your book, When It's Your Turn and It's Always Your Turn. And it kickstarted my interest in entrepreneurship and threw me down a rabbit hole I never thought I'd go down. And it's now become my life. So thank you for doing the work. Thank you for doing the practice. Thank you for the discussion. And I can't wait for all that you'll continue to create and the collaborations that come along with it. So Seth, much appreciated.
Well, thank you both. You're giving me hope too.